people of Natchitoches were amazed to see Eli Pleasant ride in, leading two wild horses and a big sorrel with a half-delirious Michael tied in the saddle. Dark news had already spread about the massacre of the Tennesseans. Baptiste Villeray and his sons rushed down from the porch to help Eli untie Michael. Michael tried but could do little to help himself. He couldn't even focus his gaze on the people who lifted him down from the saddle and carried him gently through the door that a wide-eyed Marie Villeray held open for them. He saw her as if through a clouded glass, but he could hear her weeping with joy that he was still alive. Mrs. Villeray hovered over him, giving crisp orders to husband and offspring alike. The Villerays put one of the smaller boys out of his bed and onto a pallet on the floor. In lucid moments, Michael realized, from the searing heat and the throbbing pain of the wound, that it had become infected, that he stood in some danger of dying here in this strange place, so far from Tennessee. He cared little at first. Death would bring an end to the pain, constantly recurring nightmare of the fusillade, the death cries, the shattering sight of his father's face at the moment the Spanish bullet struck him. Mordecai's blood was a crimson stain that burned itself into Michael's soul and would remain there long after the clothing had been washed clean. Again and again, Michael awoke, crying out in the midst of a fevered dream. Usually, he found the girl Marie sitting beside his bed, dark eyes soft in sympathy, her hands gripping his, trying to pull him up from the abyss and back to the reality of the moment. The olive color of her face would remind him that she too carried Spanish blood like the men who had murdered his father. At times he wanted to turn away from her, but he could not. Once he dreamed his mother had kissed him. He reached for her and his eyes came open. He saw Marie's face, inches above his own. She kissed him again, and he knew it had been only half a dream. Little by little, the fever drained away. The swelling subsided. He had only the vaguest idea how many days it had been. Eli sat on the edge of Michael's narrow bed.
I'll soon be able to take you home to your mama and family.
That thought brought Michael a mixture of joy and dread. He would be glad to leave this alien place, this land where most people spoke in languages he didn't understand, and so many of them, by the darker hue of their skin, were a constant reminder of the terrible thing he had endured. But he dreaded facing his mother, his brothers and sisters, having to tell them the brutal circumstances of his father's death. He was haunted by a recurring sense of guilt that the others had died and he had lived. It was as if by surviving he had somehow betrayed Mordecai and Old Man Wilson, the Macklins, and the rest. He tried to tell Eli, but Eli didn't understand.
It's every man's duty to survive if he can. He owes it to them that didn't, so we can keep on fighting in their name.
Michael tried to tell the girl Marie. Her eyes watched him intently as he spilled out all his angers and doubts and fears. He realized she didn't understand a tenth of what he said, for English was not her language. Now that his mind was clear, he made it up that he would learn at least some French. He was stung by frustration when he tried to tell her about Tennessee and knew she did not comprehend. She would sit at his bedside and talk to him for an hour at a time, smiling, often laughing. He felt a strong sense of loss because he didn't know what she was saying. But he enjoyed the music of her voice. It made him forget that her skin was darker than his own, dark like that of the soldiers in Texas. He would point to his hand and ask her what the French word for it was.
Mouth.
He would point to his eye.
Oi.
What's the word for mouth?
Bouche.
He would try to repeat and get the words for hand and mouth confused. He would tell her the words in English. She would repeat them until she had them memorized. She never seemed to mix them up. She always remembered.
You're smarter than I am.
He was glad she didn't understand him. A thing like that could go to a woman's head. By the time he was up and walking out onto the porch to take in the sun and the fresh air, he knew probably 50 French and Spanish words, mostly for the necessities such as food and the like. He had not learned how to string them together in any logical manner that would even approach normal conversation. Often he had trouble remembering which language a word belonged to, French or Spanish. When Marie talked to him now, he could pick out many stray words, though sometimes not enough to follow her full meaning. The words didn't matter. He could read meaning in her eyes, in the tone of her voice. As he strengthened, as he became able to walk to the river and back unassisted, and without having to rest every few minutes, he could see a worry in her eyes that betrayed the forced levity in her conversation. The day came when they stood on the bank together, watching flatboats drift on the Red's easy current.
What's the matter?
Soon you go. Too soon.
I have to. I gotta let Mama know I'm alive, and I gotta tell her about Papa.
I wish... Je vous souhaite never jamais à quitter.
Michael did not know the words, but he thought he knew what she meant.
I know. In some ways, I'm gonna hate to leave, but I got to be going home.
Marie clung to his arm as if she feared to let go, lest he leave her now.
You will remember? You will not forget?
I couldn't forget.
Marie raised up on tiptoe and kissed him. He flushed, for he felt sure people were watching, but he did not resist or pull away. She broke free suddenly and ran, leaving him there on the riverbank to make his slow way back to the house alone. He was flustered, uncertain, and warmed in a manner he had never been before. The day came soon when Eli saddled Jug and Big Red for the journey home. Michael didn't see Marie at the breakfast table and asked Baptiste about her. Baptiste only shrugged.
She does not feel well. She does not come.
An emptiness settled over Michael.
I'd at least like to tell her goodbye.
Baptiste avoided his eyes.
I will tell her you asked.
Walking out to the shed where Eli waited, Michael looked in vain at the window of the room where Marie slept. He saw no sign of her. Eli took a last tug at the rope that tied a pack on a third horse. He had managed to trade the two half-broken wild horses for one old pack horse, and enough of the necessaries to see them home, provided the hunting stayed good all the way.
You about ready, Michael?
Michael had noticed that Eli no longer called him boy.
I reckon so. I said my goodbyes to most everybody anyway.
Michael was still sore and weak, and Eli gave him a boost up into the saddle. Then Eli swung onto Jug's back and tugged on the long rope attached to the pack horse's halter. The Villeray family was lined up on the porch, waving, all except one. Michael swallowed, waving back. They had just gone a little way up the street.
Michael! Michael!
Michael swung down from the saddle, needing no help. Marie ran to him, and he swept her into his arms. They clung for a moment. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she pulled away to arm's length.
Michael! I love...
She turned and ran back toward the house, her head down. Michael stood slump-shouldered, watching until she disappeared through the door. Eli waited a minute or two.
It's a long way to Tennessee.
Eli set an easy pace eastward, following the route they'd taken coming west toward Texas. The traveling days were short at first, lengthening as Michael gained strength and was able to ride longer without rest. Big Red had a comfortable gait and infinite patience. Michael could well understand why Uncle Benjamin had put so much stock in the horse and why Mordecai had liked the animal. Michael slept little the final night out, visualizing his homecoming, trying to compose in his mind what he should say to his mother and the family. It all evaporated when they broke out of the woods and came upon the field where the corn was ripening. Michael's eyes brimmed as he saw his brothers and sisters working, harvesting the ears with knives, dropping them into sacks they dragged along the rows. All work stopped suddenly as the youngsters turned to stare in disbelief. Michael's older brother Joseph and younger brother Andrew came to the pole fence, their blue eyes wide in wonder. Heather, Annie, and little James moved up uncertainly behind them.
Michael, you ain't a ghost?
No, it's me. Well, it's left of me.
The girls climbed the fence.
Michael!
He stepped down from the sorrel horse and hugged them. Heather first, then Annie, long and fiercely, while little James wrapped both arms around Michael's legs. He felt Annie's tears wet and warm against his cheek. They reminded him of tears he had felt at Natchitoches, and they mixed with his own. Joseph kept staring.
But how? Cyrus said...
Michael straightened, glancing up at Eli.
I'll be almighty interested in hearing what Cyrus said, but later.
The field work was abandoned. All the young Lewises followed afoot as Eli and Michael rode to the cabin. Michael smelled the wood smoke and looked at the rock chimney. There had always been something warmly reassuring about smoke rising from the chimney and curling upward into invisibility against the blue sky. He swung stiffly to the ground, favoring his arm and shoulder. Andrew held out his hand to take the reins and silently pointed his chin toward the kitchen door. Patience bent over the fireplace, stirring something in a blackened pot hanging low over the bright red coals. The baby Dora was asleep on a blanket on the floor.
Mama?
She went stiff. She let the metal spoon slide into the pot and rubbed her hand against her apron. She turned slowly, almost painfully, her eyes full of hope and fear, of joy and despair.
Michael?
Yes, Mama.
They stared at each other across the width of the room for a long moment. Then both moved at once into each other's arms.
Oh.
There were no words, not for a while. Finally, Patience drew back and stared at him, her eyes awash with tears.
Then Cyrus was wrong about you. Maybe about your papa, too?
Not about papa. They killed him. They killed them all except me and Eli.
She hugged him again.
Now, Joseph, you hurry over to your Uncle Benjamin's. He'll want to know. They'll all want to know.
I'll tell everybody.
Michael turned.
Don't tell Cyrus Blackwood.
Michael glanced a moment at Eli, standing like a dark shadow in the doorway.
Me and Eli, we'll want to tell Cyrus ourselves.
They came upon Cyrus by sunrise. He was sitting on the ground with his back against a tree, watching his wife and sons and daughters harvesting corn from their poor, rocky little field.
Hey, you, Isaac! You watch what you're doing now. You're missing some of them ears.
The boy Isaac was the first to see Michael and Eli. He dropped his sack and stared.
Boy, you don't be going lazy on me now. Everybody's got to tote his share of the load.
Isaac kept staring until Cyrus finally turned. He seemed to blanch. He blinked, and his hands began to tremble. His right hand went to his ratty beard. It took a minute for him to recover sufficiently to push to his feet. He swayed, his mouth sagging open.
No. You're dead. You're both dead.
Michael tried to speak, but found his throat tight with pent-up anger. Eli spoke for him.
If we were dead, it was you got us killed, Cyrus. It was you that played the Judas.
I had no choice. I didn't know they'd kill everybody.
They didn't kill Michael. You went off and left him to die.
Yeah, I didn't know. I thought he was dead when I left.
That's a lie. I was calling for you not to go. You heard me.
Eli had not let Michael fetch his rifle over here. Now Michael knew why, for he felt his hands begin to tremble uncontrollably. If he had his rifle in them now, he would probably kill Cyrus in the sight of his family. He felt an overwhelming urge to kill him anyway, without the rifle. He raised his shaking hands and reached down toward Cyrus's throat. Eli's fingers firmly gripped Michael's good shoulder.
That's enough, son. Enough for now. Let's be going along.
Cyrus leaned against the tree to steady himself, and he managed a belated show of bravado.
Oh, that's a lie, boy. I never done no such a thing. You go telling people a lie like that, I won't stand for it, you hear me?
Michael fastened Cyrus with a gaze that simmered in hatred.
I'll tell everybody who'll listen. I'll tell them you're a coward and a Judas, and if you come looking for me, bring a gun. I'll be damned easy to find. Come on, Eli, let's go home.
Tennessee, 1816. Michael was done growing. At 6 feet, he was as tall as his father had been, and sometimes people who had known Mordecai reacted with startled eyes at the sight of Michael. They swore he'd become the image of Mordecai Lewis, rangy and strong, his face beginning to take on the stone-chiseled edges, the stern jaw that had been the mark of his father, though at the moment it was hidden by a winter's growth of whiskers. His blue eyes could be severe and unyielding, yet had the same faraway look sometimes as when Mordecai had dreamed of distant places yet unseen. But people remarked that there was more pain in Michael's eyes, and occasionally a quicker flare of anger. Considering what those eyes had witnessed, they said there was good reason. He felt a sharp tug against the pack mule's lead rope, and turned to find the animal had tried to go around the opposite side of a tree from the horse Michael was riding.
Damn you, Jethro!
Michael regarded the move as stubbornness rather than stupidity. The mule had stoutly resisted bearing the heavy weight of Michael's winter fur catch and had given in only to a determined will more stubborn than his own. 21 now and going on 22, Michael could respect a strong will, for he had one by inheritance from his father Mordecai. But he had made up his mind that when he sold his pelts, he'd sell the mule along with them. Respect and acceptance were not the same. With the first sharp, cold spell of the winter, the field work finished, Michael had gone off by himself deep into the woods, as had been his custom the last several years. He had slept in a tent sometimes. Other times, when he expected the camp to last a while, he would throw up a rude log shelter against the snow and the bitter winds, running his trap lines in wild country where white men's boots had seldom trod. He had encountered other men only 3 times all of this past winter. They were like himself, eager for a brief visit with their own kind, for the sound of kindred voices, then just as eager to set off again, alone. They were solitary men who accepted loneliness as the price of putting behind them the noisy demands of other humankind, the clang and clatter of so-called civilized life. Michael no longer wondered what had drawn his father so often to the woods and had kept him so long from home. He knew. A man could think, and no one would ask what he was thinking. He could talk to himself, and no one would interrupt to ask what he meant. He could listen to the voices of the forest, speaking in 1,000 tongues, and learn to understand them all. When old memories and old fears threatened to smother him in the dark of night, and he awoke shouting and fighting, there was no one to question, or blame, or pity. He could confront his private torments in his own way, and no one else would know. Restless, his older brother Joseph said of him, but Michael was only restless at home, on the farm, or in the settlements. Except when the dark dreams came, he was not restless on the trail, in the forests, or camped on the rivers. There he could find a measure of peace, of contentment that escaped him where people lived in clusters. Like his father, his mother said, and Michael accepted that as a compliment, though he was not sure patience always meant it to be one. She had been taken hard by the death of Mordecai Lewis. She had been fearful of it for years, because Mordecai had not been one to seek out the safe and easy path, or long abide one if he happened to cross it. She had worn the widow's black a respectable period, while Uncle Benjamin had watched over her family as if it was his own. When he and Patience decided a proper time had passed, he had made the 2 families one, taking Patience to bring warmth back into a home left cold by the death of Aunt Nancy. And in due course, the combined family grew once again with the addition of a baby boy named Jonathan. Now the boy was 3 years old, and still Michael couldn't quite bring himself to call him brother. It was a hell of a thing, he knew, to blame a child so young, so unaware. But Michael couldn't help it. He couldn't quite accept this final affront to his father's memory, this symbol that his mother had accepted a place in the bed of another man, even his own uncle. He had moved back from Uncle Benjamin's farm to the old claim, ostensibly to help Brother Joseph keep up the place. Ownership had passed to Joseph, the eldest, as was the custom. Joseph had taken excellent care of it, as he had from the time he was old enough to handle a mule and a plow by himself, take on the responsibilities that should have been Mordecai's. A hard worker, Joseph was, a man who knew what he wanted from life, and believed the way to get it was to irrigate the growing ground with sweat. Michael found no fault with him, but his interests were often different from Joseph's. Michael understood Joseph's ways better than Joseph understood Michael's. They came to disagreement at times, never in a bitter manner, but never quite finding a compromise agreeable to them both. Late last year, when the crops were laid by, Joseph had taken himself a wife, a farmer's daughter, down on Buck Holler, a niece of old man Wilson, who died with Papa in Texas. She was a dandy girl, good-looking, handy with the pots and the skillet, but she and Joseph had no need of anyone except each other right now. Michael had been glad to light out for the woods with the winter's first chill. His brother Andrew, 19 going on 20, and fully able to hold up his end on any problem that might arise, had wanted to go with him. But Michael had preferred to spend the winter alone, to sort out his thoughts, to see if he could arrive at some plan for the future. He couldn't see spending another spring and summer on the old farm where everything brought back his father's memory. He no longer felt there was a real place for him there, compromising the privacy of the newlyweds. And though he loved his mother and respected his uncle, the larger farm was not for him either. Now the grass was rising, the birds were finding their way north, and the shape of the future remained as elusive as when he'd set out months ago to find it. Ahead of him, Michael saw a fork in the trail. He knew he must soon make a decision about another fork in another trail, and he had no idea which direction he might take. For now, he took the right-hand fork that would lead him to Miller's Crossing. Sizemore Miller had been a friend of his father's, and now was a friend of Michael's, running a little trading post where a man could buy a few necessaries for the trail, or get a jug of decent enough squeezins, or even sell a mule load of pelts if he didn't fancy going all the way back to the settlements where prices tended to be higher. The log structure came in sight around a bend of the trail. A man came out onto the small porch and stood waiting, wiping his hands on an apron tied around his middle. Michael knew at a glance that this was not his friend Miller. This was a stranger. The place was littered with trash. Sizemore Miller had always been as fussy as an old woman about cleanliness and order.
How do?
Michael took a careful look around before he stepped down. His rifle lay across his lap, and he kept his hand upon it, for not all the wolves ran on four legs. He had learned that in a bitter way on the trail to Texas some 5 years ago. Strangers were suspect until he had time to size them up.
I do. Come on in. You look like a man who ain't hefted a jug in a spell.
Where's Sizemore at?
Gone west. Sold me this place and lit out as soon as the grass begun to rise. Going to seek his fortune.
He didn't say nothing about it when I come by here last fall.
Bound for Louisiana, so he told me. Hoping he might open Texas up for settlement someday soon. You heard of Texas?
Old memories rushed back unbidden.
I've heard of it.
The man on the porch motioned toward a row of posts.
Well, tie up your beast and come on in and have a drink with me.
The man gave the mule's load a moment's study.
Would you be interested in settling that peltry?
It's what it's for if you're willing to pay me a fair return for a winter's work.
Michael tied the horse and mule and stepped up onto the low, narrow, rough planking porch. He paused a moment, looking up at the roof over his head. It seemed unnatural after those long months under the sky and the trees. He followed the proprietor through the open door into the gloom of a log building that had only one window. He blinked and gave his eyes a moment to adjust themselves. He saw two men sitting on a bench and leaning against the back wall. One of them passed a jug to the other.
Howdy, Michael Lewis.
Michael stared at him, trying to see beyond a winter's growth of ragged black beard, not unlike his own.
That you, Finnis Blackwood?
Michael made no move to walk over and shake hands.
It's me.
Finnis made no move either. Studying him, Michael decided Finnis was looking more like his father Cyrus all the time. One thing the world didn't need was more people like Cyrus Blackwood.
You all are friends, then. Well, a friend of Finnis Blackwood's is a friend of mine.
The proprietor extended his hand.
My name's Ephraim Crow.
Michael accepted the hand with reservations. Any friend of Finnis Blackwood's was automatically suspect.
How do?
Fleety! Fleety girl! You come on out here, bring us a jug of that best corn liquor, you hear me?
Fleety came through a door that led to a shotgun-shaped set of rooms in the back. She was hardly more than a girl. Barefoot, long hair hanging raggedly toward her waist, mercifully hiding part of a plain homespun dress that lacked any semblance of color. Her face was comely enough, Michael thought, but her eyes were dull and without life. She seemed to be walking in some dream of her own. He suspected she was not of whole mind. Somehow, seeing her carried him back to another girl, the black-eyed French-Spanish Marie Villeray, who had sat so often beside his bed while he was recuperating from his wound. He wondered why she came to his mind now. There was no comparison between her and this unfortunate creature. Michael found Crow appraising him carefully.
I don't reckon you've seen a woman in a while, have you?
Not since fall. That your daughter?
Oh, no. She's just an orphan girl I've taken pity on, give a home to. Does the cooking and cleaning up around here. And, whatever else I tell her to.
Michael was keenly aware that the girl was watching him with something like resignation. Her eyes made him uncomfortable. Crow pulled a corncob stopper from the jug she had brought and handed it to Michael.
Take a snort of that, why don't you? You'll feel like you just shot a bear.
The whiskey burned like fire going down his throat and kept burning all the way to his stomach. Aside from that, it wasn't bad.
Made it myself, so I know just what all's in it. Have yourself another.
Michael shook his head.
One's enough. I don't believe in drinking until the trading's done. You want to take a look at them pelts?
Ain't no big hurry about it.
The girl gave Michael a look that he took for invitation and went back through the door. Crow's gaze followed her.
I'll tell you what. Why don't you go back yonder and play with Fleety a while? You take all the time you want. And I'll look at what you got on that mule, and when you're done with the girl, well, I'll bet you we can come to terms.
Michael frowned, looking toward the door where the girl had gone. He was stirred to resentment that Crow thought him so lacking in morality.
Sizemore never offered nothing like that.
Yeah, well, I carry a fuller stock of merchandise.
She better than his whiskey. I've tried them both.
Revulsion made Michael's stomach turn. The girl was a slave, or next to it, he realized. It was not that he had any strong principles against a man and a woman doing what their natures bade them to do. It was just that he hated the thought of the woman having no say in the matter, or in this case, perhaps, not the mind to realize she should have any say. Somehow he pictured Marie Villeray helplessly caught in a trap like this. The improbable image stirred him to an unexpected anger. He took a step backward toward the door.
Much obliged for the drink. I'll be moving on.
Fleety's waiting for you.
I don't hold with such as that.
You accepted my whiskey. Ain't you gonna even let me make you a bid on that peltry?
Michael saw Finnis and his companion stand up and set their jug on the floor. He sensed that they were moving to Crow's aid. He kept backing up until he reached his rifle that he had left standing beside the door. He lifted it in a manner calculated to carry a quiet warning without being an open threat.
I'll leave you a bait of venison for the whiskey. I ain't seen nothing here that I especially like, including your friends.
You always had a big mouth when it come to us Blackwoods.
I ain't said half of what I was thinking.
Michael backed out across the porch and untied his horse and mule. Crow and Blackwood and the third man came onto the porch and watched him untie a leg of venison. He pitched it to the rough pine floor at Crow's feet.
That's a lot more than I owe you.
Crow did not speak, but his eyes said the incident was not yet over. His gaze went to the pack mule, and Michael could read the calculation. It was a long way to the settlements. Many an accident might befall the unwary. Michael gave Finnis, Blackwood, and the other man a quick study. He had been hearing ugly rumors about Finnis for some time now. Barns that had been burned, a couple of men had disappeared. In every case, Finnis had had a grievance. Finnis had many grievances. Michael decided he might just as well have one more.
I'd take it real unkindly if anybody was to follow after me.
Michael swung into the saddle and laid the rifle across his lap, its muzzle not quite pointing at the men on the porch. As he rode away, he saw the girl standing by a back door, shading her eyes with one hand, watching him without any expression that he could discern. He wondered again why this dull-eyed drudge, traded like a piece of poor merchandise, should make him think of Marie, whose dark eyes had been full of life, energy, and emotion. So long as he kept looking behind him, he could see the three men still standing on the porch, watching him as closely as he watched them. The dim trail shortly made a turn back into the timber, and the trading post was out of sight. Michael suspected a council of war had begun there. Pulse quickening, he touched his heels to the horse's ribs and moved him into a brisk trot. The mule Jethro reluctantly stepped up its pace after a moment's stubborn resistance to the lead rope. It occurred to Michael that his friend Sizemore Miller might not have left this place voluntarily. He might not have left at all. It was not beyond reason that he might be buried in some dark and hidden place out in the timber. Such things happened. After 3 or 4 miles, he came upon a shallow creek running a little higher and muddier than usual because of spring rains. He paused a moment to look back and listen. The mule pranced nervously and kept him from hearing if anyone might be coming along his back trail. But intuition told him someone was. He led the mule out into the creek, then turned downstream and went perhaps 50 yards before he rode out again, the same side he'd entered. He circled back through the woods toward the trail, dismounted, and tied the two animals where the timber would hide them. He took his rifle, his shot pouch, and powder horn and walked back toward the trail, careful to remain behind the underbrush as much as possible. Near the trail, he settled down on his heels, his rifle across his lap, and waited. The wait was short. Michael crouched low but was able to see through the foliage. Crow had not come. They were just the two, Finnish Blackwood and his companion. Both carried rifles across their laps.
I don't know as I hold with killing somebody, Finnish. Don't seem like a mule load of furs is worth that much.
Well, we can't just take the furs and leave him go. As soon as he gets home, he'll have the law after him.
Law's been after you before.
It ain't caught me or nothing, and it won't this time. We'll bury him where there won't nobody find him. They'll just figure the engine's got him, or some varmint did, or he froze to death during the winter. Procell will pay us right well for them pelts and for the horse and mule.
Michael gritted his teeth, the anger rising like tainted meat trying to fight its way back up. He waited until the two men had put their horses into the water before he arose from his hiding place.
Stop where you're at!
Finnish Blackwood whirled his horse around, but his companion halted dead in his tracks and sat there as if frozen, the muddy water washing around his horse's legs. Finnish's eyes were large as he stared at Michael and at Michael's rifle pointed right where his black mustache met his nose.
Michael, wasn't looking for you here.
But you were looking for me. Well, now you found me. You talked mighty big about how you'd kill me and take my winter's catch. Let's see you start.
Now, Michael, you got awful poor hearing if that's what you think we was talking about. It was the farthest thing from our mind to do you any harm. Me and Bilks, we was just starting on our way home is all.
My hearing is fine. Now, the first thing I want y'all to do is drop your rifles.
In the water?
In the water.
Finnish had his hands on his own rifle lying across his lap. He could bring it around to bear upon Michael in the winking of an eye.
There's two of us, in case you ain't counted.
I can count.
Can't get but one of us. The other one will have you before you can spit.
I know that. But what you don't know is which one of you I'll kill. You might want to study on it.
Finnish's companion settled the matter without studying much. He dropped his rifle. Finnish had to think about it, but after a moment's further consideration of the weapon pointed at his nose, he let the rifle slip out of his lap and into the running creek. There was an instant of foam atop the brown water, then no trace. Michael reasoned that the two rifles' weight probably wouldn't let them be carried far, but it would take a long and diligent search in ice-cold water to retrieve them.
Now your shot pouches and powder horns. Everything.
This is a wild old country.
It won't be half as wild with you disarmed. Do it.
Finnish followed orders.
I can't get rid of my shot. You have any idea how much it costs?
It's getting on to planting time, and you'll be too busy to go hunting for a while anyway. All right, y'all can ride back out of the creek, but I want you both to stop on the bank.
You ain't fixing to kill us, are you?
He won't do that. Them Lewises ain't the kind that shoots unarmed men. But they'll kill a man's reputation, accusing him. Talking about him behind his back.
If you mean your old daddy, I ain't saying anything behind his back that I ain't told him to his face. And looking at you, I'd say the blood is running true.
The Blackwood family ain't gonna tolerate your loose talk forever, Michael.
If you think it's just talk, you come and try me.
Finnish eyed the rifle.
You got the gun.
I have. And the gun says for you all to get down and take the saddles off them horses. Now.
Finnish unfastened the cinch.
You ain't fixing to take our horses, are you?
I'd be afraid to show up in the settlements with them. Probably stolen.
The men took the saddles off and put them on the ground.
Take the bridles off them.
Michael watched as the men complied.
Now whip them to a run. Both of them.
But you can't...
Do it!
Damn! Yeah!
Finnish struck his horse sharply across the rump with the bridle reins. Bilks was a little easier, but his horse went pounding back down the trail with Finnish's in a hard lope, head held high in a manner that indicated he wouldn't stop running until he reached the trading post.
Now, I figure by the time you all find your rifles in that creek and walk back to Crow's place, you oughtn't to be interested in coming after me again. And I sure won't be interested in seeing you anymore. But if I do, my friendly nature is about used up.
Finnis Blackwood's eyes were narrowed almost to the point of being closed, but the cold anger showed through.
You Lewises are a high and mighty bunch, big landowners and all that. But the higher you climb, the farther you'll fall. You'll wish you hadn't seen me today.
I already wish I hadn't seen you today or any other time. Now I'm fixing to be on my way. I want you all to stand right there where I can watch you till I'm plumb gone.
When Michael retrieved his horse and mule and crossed the creek, he looked back one last time. Finnis and Bilks were wading in water above their knees looking for their rifles. Michael went first to the old farm because he felt more at home there than on Uncle Benjamin's place, though the farm now belonged to his older brother, Joseph. He had paused at a nearby creek to shave so Joseph's wife, Emily, would not have to look at the whiskers that had protected his face all winter. He carried with him a freshly killed fat doe so he would not be a burden at his brother's table. As he expected, he found Joseph in the field, spring planting in the newly warmed soil. Emily stood at the edge of the freshly turned rows, and Michael knew at a glance that all the planting had not been done in the field. She showed every sign of approaching motherhood.
Uncle Michael. Damn, that won't take some getting used to.
It seemed not so long ago that he'd been a small boy himself, following along after Joseph, as his younger brother Andrew in turn had followed after him. Time moves too fast anymore. Joseph laid the plow over on its side and walked out to the end of the row to stand by Emily, his arm around her, as Michael approached. Emily smiled. She had the same sparkling blue eyes as all the Lewis women, possibly one reason Joseph had been drawn to her. Joseph studied the mule load of pelts.
Looks like you had a good winter.
Michael glanced at Emily's stomach, pushing out conspicuously.
Looks like you all did too.
Emily blushed and looked down. Joseph squeezed his wife's shoulder.
The baby will be here early in the summer, best we can tell. You ought to find you a good wife, Michael. You don't know how much you're missing, sleeping out in the woods.
Michael couldn't help thinking about the slow-moving girl he had seen at Crow's place, and comparing the blank look in her face to the glow he could see in Emily's.
You're lucky people, both of you, but this life's not for me.
Joseph was a farmer, with his feet firmly planted on the ground, his future set right here on this place. Michael had no plans, not even an idea what his future might hold. How could a woman, any woman, understand the dark memories and dreams that haunted him and sometimes drove him away from other people?
You'll stay a while, won't you?
The night. Then I best ride over and see about Mama and them. They all right?
Everybody's made the winter in good shape. You ought to see your little brother Jonathan. He can already ride a horse, and he can see a squirrel farther than I can.
Poor kid is ruined for life. That was the way I started, and probably Papa, too.
It won't seem right, our little one having to call him Uncle, and there won't be but 4 years or so difference between them.
Uncomfortably, Michael considered that Joseph had called Jonathan brother. But he was not. Not a full brother, anyway. That thought still troubled him, even so many years after his mother's remarriage. In the faces of his other brothers and sisters, he could see a little of Papa. In Jonathan's, he could not. Michael unsaddled the horse and took the pack from the mule, staking them on grass a little way from the double cabin. He felt ill at ease sitting long in the kitchen with Emily, for it was her kitchen now, not his mother's. He had drunk a cup of coffee with her, then gone outside, picked up the chopping axe, and attacked a big woodpile that Joseph had built up during the long winter months, when there was no field work to be done, and when the snow was not too deep for him to drag deadfall timber out of the forest. By the time sunset brought Joseph trudging wearily in from the field, trailing behind the work mule, Michael had built up a goodly stack of wood cut to fireplace length. It was a chore no woman in Emily's condition should be expected to do herself, and Joseph's long days in the field would make it difficult for him to find the time. The way Emily kissed Joseph at the door, a stranger might think they'd not seen each other in a month. Michael felt like an intruder and turned back to the woodpile to fetch an armload of the newly cut fuel for the fireplace. He gave the couple a little time before he walked through the kitchen door and stacked the wood neatly within easy reach of the fire. The smell of a woman's cooking could make a bachelor reassess his condition. So could the warmth in Emily's eyes as she looked at her husband. It made Michael feel lonely. Joseph wanted to hear about Michael's winter. There was not much to tell, so it didn't take long. Michael mentioned stopping at Miller's Crossing and finding a new proprietor there. For Emily's sake, he didn't mention the girl, Fleety.
Man's name was Crow. Claimed he bought out Sizemore Miller and Sizemore went west. You reckon he really did?
I ain't heard about Sizemore, but there's been stories about people going yonder way trying for Texas.
I couldn't ever go there. Not after what happened to my Uncle Amos and y'all's daddy. I don't see how anybody could go. Must be a terrible place.
It is. And yet...
Michael could not finish expressing the thought, for it seemed a hopeless contradiction. He often remembered his exhilaration in the size and freshness of the land, how it had seemed a brand new piece of world never touched by man, how his father had taken to it with an enthusiasm Michael had never seen. But always, the idyllic part of the memory would be shattered by the intrusion of an opposite side, the fear, the sudden violence, the horror of wholesale murder.
Don't worry, Emily. You're Lewis now, and you can bet that no Lewises will ever go to Texas again.
Joseph looked to Michael as if for support, but Michael fixed his gaze on coals that flared red, then darkened as their inner heat surged and ebbed in the fireplace. His mind carried him back to long-ago campfires, far away. Campfires where he had sat with his father and the others, pondering the mysteries of an immense land new to them all. Those men were like ghosts now. Ghosts who walked through his fretful dreams in the night and invaded his restless mind during the day. Times it was almost as if he could hear his father calling him. There was no way he could explain that to Joseph, much less to Emily.
It's been a long day. If y'all will excuse me, I think I'll go spread out my bedding out yonder in the shed.
Michael always dreaded returning to his uncle's farm. It was not that Uncle Benjamin didn't greet him like a long-lost son, for he invariably did. He knew his uncle regarded him as one of his own. The problem lay within Michael himself. The rare times when he was able to look at his image in the mirror, he saw Mordecai Lewis there. It was, in a sense, as if Michael had taken over much of his father's role. But Uncle Benjamin had undertaken that role, too. Try as he might, Michael couldn't get over the feeling that they were somehow competitors. Worst of all, though he tried never to show it, he could not reconcile himself to his mother's acceptance of Uncle Benjamin in Papa's place. Especially as that acceptance was manifested in the little boy Jonathan. Dora was no longer the baby of the family. It was Uncle Benjamin he saw first, and he had to force himself through the pretense that he reciprocated all the good feeling he could see in his uncle's eyes. Benjamin hugged him.
Oh, God, it's good to see you, Michael. It is great to have you home.
Michael never quite accepted his uncle's farm as home. His younger brothers came up out of the fields to greet him. Andrew was breathless from running so he could be the first. James, 11, was taking his time. He had more of Joseph's quiet reserve. Andrew, almost 20 now, threw his arms around Michael as if he'd returned from the dead. He had returned from the dead once, and Andrew had never quite conquered the dread of that experience.
I wish you'd never go out like that again. We never know if you're coming home.
I always come home.
But an inner voice told him he had no home, not anymore. Home was something vague, someplace out yonder in the forests, or beyond the rivers. Someplace like his father had sought all his life and never found. Michael often wondered if he would ever find it. Heather was 16 now and filled out in the first full bloom of young womanhood. She kissed him quickly, then pulled back. Dora, edging up on 7, looked like Annie used to look back when Papa went away. She kissed Michael, as Heather had. Annie, 13, was still the most demonstrative in the family. She threw her arms around Michael's neck, hugged him hard, and let him go. But then hugged him a second time, as if once just wasn't enough. She still favored Michael, seeing Papa in him. His mother's greeting was silent but long. She held him as if she feared to let him go, lest he not return. She looked him up and down.
Oh, you're a poor cook, son. Send us a slab of bacon, yar. Like your pop always was coming home.
I've never starved yet. A few days of yours and Heather's cooking and I'll flesh out like a hog on acorns.
Michael saw contentment in his mother's eyes. Gone was the anxiety of the old days when she had worried constantly over Mordecai. When he was coming home, if he was coming home. All the time shouldering not only her responsibilities but his. If anything, she looked younger now than she used to. Michael would have to give Uncle Benjamin credit for that. Times, before he could catch himself, he would almost get to thinking she would have been better off to have married Uncle Benjamin in the beginning instead of Papa, and to have let Papa go on roaming the way his natural bent had always led him, without anyone left behind to encumber him with guilt. Michael never let such thoughts run too far, for they seemed disloyal to his father. Had it happened that way, he and his brothers would not be here. Except, perhaps, Jonathan. The boy clung to Michael's leg.
Michael! Michael!
Michael started to reach down for him, but could not complete the move. He saw the hurt in his mother's eyes.
He's your brother.
Half-brother.
Michael wished he hadn't spoken. Patience stared into Michael's eyes until he had to look away.
You are a good man, Michael. You're much like your father, too much at times. But he had one thing you seemed to have lost. He had understanding. He would have understood how your Uncle Benjamin and I needed one another. Your father didn't know how to show love sometimes, but it was always there. There was a side to him that you couldn't know. Only a woman could.
Michael's face burned. He looked at the boy still clinging to his leg.
Michael, come see the new kittens in the shed.
Maybe Texas burned that out of you. But if you can't find a way to get it back someday, you'll be a lonely man as long as you live, son.
Michael placed his hand on Jonathan's head and held it there a minute, then forced himself to lift the boy up into his arms.
Where'd you say them kittens are?
At supper, Michael announced his intention of going to the settlement the next day to see about selling his furs and the mule. Benjamin Lewis questioned him at some length about the animal. Michael guessed he was considering buying it himself, and he tried to spare his uncle some grief by describing all of Jethro's worst habits. Benjamin Lewis was a man who knew mules, so he was easy to discourage.
I've been needing another because we've got so many hands now to help with the planting. If it's all the same with you, Michael, I believe I'll ride along with you and see if I can happen upon a good mule for sale.
Michael was never totally comfortable around his uncle anymore, but he knew no graceful way to decline. He put on the most pleasant face he could manage.
You'd be welcome.
They were up at daylight to load the pelts on the mule and to saddle their horses. By the time that was done, Patience and the girls had breakfast ready. Afterward, Benjamin assigned all the boys to their respective jobs.
Frank, I want you to ride out and see if you can find that old brindle milk cow. She's bound to have had her calf by now. James, you take a hoe to those weeds in your mama's garden. They're sapping the moisture we'll be needing to get the first vegetables up. And Andrew, I wish you'd get started planting that south field.
As the boys hustled off to their respective jobs, Benjamin Lewis watched them with satisfaction. He said something Michael had heard from him 100 times.
Idle hands invite the devil's work instead of the Lord's.
I expect you're right. Blackwood boys are proof enough if any was needed.
Michael had not mentioned his run-in with Finnis Blackwood. It would just cause unnecessary fretting by the family. Benjamin nodded and swung into the saddle.
Yep. I can't see much sign any of them will turn out better than their old daddy Cyrus. Drinking all the time, gambling, fighting. I do believe they'd rather shed blood than sweat. Ain't one of them does any more work than he absolutely has to keep from starving to death. Well, maybe Isaac. He'll work a little.
Michael never saw much of Isaac, the one who had chunked rocks at him and Andrew the time they had fought over rightful possession of a doe Michael had shot. Isaac worked for wages on various farms and sent money home to help feed other family members whose ambition was not as strong as their appetites.
Last fall before I went into the woods, I heard Isaac was in jail.
Well, he was. They let him out at Christmas. Isaac has a hard time holding the job for very long. He'll fight anybody who'll give him a reason, and he's not choosy about the reason.
Like all the Lewises, Benjamin studied the sky a lot, trying to find there some clue about the weather to come. Riding along, he looked up at the eastern sky where the sun was already taking the spring cool from the morning air. The coolness felt good, but the crops needed warmth to grow.
It's been a cold winter, but I do believe this spring is going to be a warm one. Good for the corn.
I'd reckon so.
Michael was unable to find much enthusiasm for the crops. He preferred the winter and trapping. He felt Benjamin's eyes appraising him at much length. He was vaguely ill at ease.
Well, there's a nice meadow over yonder that I've been wanting to break out and put into something useful. I just haven't had the time. If you'd be willing, I'd turn it over to you on the halves. I'll furnish the mule and the plow and the seed. You furnish the labor.
Again, Michael began searching for some graceful way to turn his uncle down.
That'd be mighty generous of you. Too generous, I'm thinking.
You're a grown man now, Michael. Needn't be out on your own. This would be a chance for you to start at a profit to us both. I'd figure out some way that in a little while the land would be yours. I've got more than I can properly see to, even with so many helping hands.
I'll study on it.
Michael felt the cool west wind at his back. He turned to face it. He fancied he could hear a calling in it from the silence of the past. Papa, maybe, way out yonder. His uncle caught the look.
Well, I've seen that same thing in your father's eye many times. He was always looking over the next hill for his fortune, but it never was there. The fortune is here, in the soil. But don't come easy, Michael. Man has got to grub and sweat for it, but at the end of the day, he can look back on his labor and know it's good. He can sit in his own cabin of an evening, by his own fire, and take pleasure in seeing that his woman and his young'uns are properly fed, and he can feel justified in the eyes of the Lord. There's happiness in that. Happiness I don't think your father, God rest him, ever really knew.
There was a happy side to Papa, one you probably never got to see much because it mostly showed on him when he was out in the woods or on the trail. I saw it on our trip to Texas. You're a farmer by nature and happy at it, but he wasn't. He was miserable trying to be one. As miserable as you'd have been if you tried to be a woodsman like you was. Everybody is born to walk his own way. You're content with yours, and I'm glad you are, but I've got too much of Papa in me. I just ain't found yet where I belong.
Some men never find where they belong. They live miserable, and they die that way.
There's got to be some place for me. I keep looking, I believe I'll find it.
Well, I hope you do. But in the meantime, there's still that meadow. And my offer stands.
Maybe for this season. I'll do some studying on it.
Michael's eye caught a movement at the edge of the woods, so quickly gone that he couldn't tell what it was. A deer, most likely. Michael's own horse looked quickly in that direction, its ears alert. He considered it strange to hear a horse from the direction of the trees, for horses didn't often stray far into the woods. They found little grass in the constant shade. And a man would seem foolish to be riding through the woods when there were good beaten trails to be had, or the broad openings where Michael and his uncle rode. He felt the first stirring of alarm, and his fingers tightened on the long rifle that lay across his saddle. He carried it always, for one never knew when meat might be had for the table.
You see anything out yonder, Uncle Benjamin?
Benjamin had heard the nicker, but he showed no concern. He'd ridden this trail 100 times or more.
Oh, probably just a hunter. He'll scare off all the game, breaking his way through that brush on horseback.
Benjamin slipped from the saddle and fell in a heap on the ground. It was Texas all over again. One shot this time instead of a volley, but Michael's reaction was instinctive, conditioned by memories lived over 1,000 times in his mind. Michael stepped instantly from the saddle and dropped to one knee, bringing the rifle up. He saw a movement in the timber, a man on horseback, whirling about. He took aim as the rider paused a moment, evidently tangled in some undergrowth. Recognition came an instant before he squeezed the trigger.
Finis Blackwood.
Through the black smoke, he thought he saw the rider jerk suddenly. Whether he was hit or reacted out of fright, Michael couldn't know. He saw the horse break into a run, the rider bent, ducking the low limbs of headlong flight. Before Michael could begin to reload, horse and rider were out of sight. Turning back to his uncle, he felt his lungs ache. He had held his breath from the instant he had seen Finnis fire the shot. He looked into Benjamin's glazing eyes and knew the bullet had struck him hard.
Good God, he's taking what was meant for me.
Benjamin Lewis had been struck high in the chest toward the right shoulder. His face was going gray with shock. For a moment, staring down at him, Michael could see only his father, shot 5 years ago in Texas. The same anger and desperation swept over him, but this time at least he was not helpless. He tore open his uncle's shirt. A glance told him the wound was bad. He looked around quickly, calculating the distance back to his uncle's house. A family named Baxter lived closer. He could see smoke rising from their chimney a half mile away.
Can you hear me, Uncle Ben?
Yes.
Michael thought he was trying to say yes.
I've got to get you onto a horse. I'll take you to the Baxters.
The mule, Jethro, had panicked and run away, back in the direction from which Michael and Benjamin had come. Benjamin's sorrel had run 100 yards and stopped, but Michael's horse stood waiting where he had stopped. Michael caught the reins and led the horse to where his uncle lay. He raised Benjamin to a sitting position.
I'm going to put you on my horse now. Think you can help me a little?
Benjamin nodded weakly. Michael got him to his feet and then lifted him into the saddle. He put his own left foot in the stirrup and swung up behind the cantle so he could hold on to his uncle.
This is liable to hurt like hell, but it won't take us long to get there.
Michael put the horse into a walk for a minute. Then, satisfied he would not let Benjamin fall, he moved into a long trot. As he came upon the Baxter's field, he saw a man and two half-grown boys working there. The man behind two mules and a moldboard plow. The boys picking up large stones, the plow turned over and carrying them to the edge of the field.
Mr. Baxter! Mr. Baxter! Help!
Michael waved his hat. The man halted the mules and stared, then comprehended that there was trouble. He unhitched a mule and jumped upon him bareback, running to catch up while Michael proceeded to the cabin. One of the boys was sent to fetch patients while Michael and Baxter probed the wound and extracted the bullet. Benjamin had lapsed into unconsciousness early in the operation, which Michael thought was merciful. He well remembered the time Eli Pleasant had performed a similar operation upon him under even cruder circumstances. For a time, Michael felt little pulse and saw no sign his uncle was breathing. A little of the old Texas feeling of helplessness came over him. It took all the strength he could muster to put it down. He did so by letting anger rise in its place. The Blackwoods. It seemed that every time a calamity struck the Lewis family, a Blackwood was behind it. Finnis had set out to take revenge upon Michael because of what had happened near Miller's Crossing. He had shot the wrong man by mischance or poor marksmanship. Benjamin Lewis lay on a rough bunk, his face still gray, his breathing so faint as to be almost imperceptible.
We ain't taking this. We ain't taking this at all.
Michael strode to the cabin's door in time to see his brother Andrew help his mother down from the wagon. Patience rushed toward the cabin, her eyes fearful. Michael stepped out to meet her and put his arms around her.
You better be prepared for the worst. It don't look good.
Patience Lewis was a strong woman. She had to be, for she had raised her family and had taken care of one farm or another by herself for much of the time she'd been married to Mordecai.
Let's see to him then.
Michael thought he might have to grab her when she took her first look at Benjamin, but she was of sterner stuff. Her moment of shock was quickly past. She summoned up all the strength that years of self-sufficiency had given her.
I don't understand. Benjamin had no enemies.
But I have. That bullet was aimed at me.
If you know who it was, let's notify the law.
I'll take care of it.
Michael realized his mother misunderstood his meaning, thinking he intended to notify the officials. He let her keep the comfort of that error, for she had more than enough to grieve for. He studied the deep sadness in her eyes and knew, if he had not already, how much Benjamin Lewis meant to her.
I'd best be getting about it.
Won't you stay with me until we know?
Andrew'll be with you. There's nothing I could do here that he can't.
Michael turned to summon his younger brother with a nod. Andrew followed him outside into the sunshine of a warm spring day. He eyed him suspiciously.
You ain't really going to the settlement, are you?
I'm going to make a settlement.
Michael had not told Andrew who had shot Benjamin, but he felt that his brother knew intuitively. Andrew had always had an uncanny knack of sensing things. Besides, he was aware of the intended robbery at the crossing.
I'll go with you.
It was me he was after. It's up to me to settle it.
If there's a bunch of them Blackwoods, I could watch your back at least.
You stay here and watch Mama. Worst comes to worst, she'll need you real bad.
You be careful then. It'd be almighty hard on her to lose two of you in the same day.
She ain't lost either one of us yet. Uncle Benjamin may be a farmer instead of a woodsman, but he's a Lewis just the same. He's a fighter.
One of the Baxter boys had caught Uncle Benjamin's sorrel and the pelt-laden mule and had brought them to the pole pen. As Michael mounted his horse, he pointed his chin toward the mule.
You just as well take the pack off him. I won't be getting to the settlement with him for a while yet.
Michael hunched in the saddle as he rode away, shoulders burdened by the task ahead of him. Elmer Kelton's Sons of Texas is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1989, Elmer Kelton. Published by arrangement with Elmer Kelton, care of Sobel Weber Associates, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Daniel Stevens, Danny Gavigan, Andy Clements, Ren Casey, James Konacek, Joe Brack, Jeff Allen, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Joseph Thornhill, Thomas Keegan, Bobby Aselford, Drew Copas, Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Jernigan, Casey Platt, Laura Reichert, Ken Jackson, Elizabeth Demery, Richard Rowan, Lily Beacon, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Sons of Texas, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Huey Calloway and Texas Rangers series. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Yeah, this son of a bitch is guilty. You know it, and I know it, and I say, let's hang the bastard.
All right, it's now time to poll the jury. Jury, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty.
Well, yeah, so say you won, so say you all.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
Mr. Matt Jensen, you have been found guilty of murder and are sentenced to hang. On his way to Yuma to hang for a crime he didn't commit, Matt Jensen will be involved in the worst train wreck in Arizona history.
How's it coming?
We pulled out a couple of the spikes, but they're damn hard to remove.
They're supposed to be hard to get out. All you have to do is pull up enough of them to be able to push the rail out a few inches.
You sure that'll stop the train?
You ever seen a train run on dirt?
Now Matt will stop at nothing to bring the men responsible for killing so many innocent people to the only justice he knows. The justice of the gun.
It's you! You son of a bitch! I'm gonna gut you like a hog!
Like an avenging angel, Matt Jensen will deliver the villains unto the hands of the devil. In Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man number 3, Purgatory.
I'll see you in hell!
Not likely. I've done my time in purgatory.
Available now in graphic audio.
You
men are aware you're trespassing on private property, aren't you?
What is your name, boy?
My name's Cal. What's yours?
Lazarus. Lazarus Cain. Have you been saved, Cal?
Saved from what?
Why, from hell and damnation, of course.
What's all this got to do with the fact you men are stealing my boss's cattle?
Now hold on, boys. I can handle this young pup alone. The Lord giveth, and he taketh away, my good boy.
When Smoke Jensen's friend and ranch hand is brutally shot while protecting his ranch, there isn't a demon in hell that could still Smoke Jensen's vengeful, bloody hands.
Did you find any papers on the man Cal described?
About the nearest one I saw was a man named Lazarus Cain. He and his gang did some raiding down in Arkansas recently, but there was no mention of his heading this way.
Well, if this Cain has decided to pay us a visit and did this to Cal, he's gonna wish he never left Arkansas.
Don't miss Smoke Jensen's bloody quest for revenge in Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 24, Guns of the Mountain Man.
You're no match for me, Jensen! I'll kill you before you can clear leather!
You reach for them guns, and one of us is gonna die.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.